May it please the court, Robert Bork has registration number 19577, appearing on behalf of the defendant appellant, Daniel Moore. And if I could, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine. You can monitor your own time as well.
Thank you. Your Honor, the defendant, Mr. Moore, had a statutory right to appointment of post-conviction counsel in this matter. Mr. Moore filed a pro se Rule 35C motion, and Judge Teresa Cisneros reviewed that motion and made a determination that it warranted appointment of counsel. Initially, she appointed the Office of the Public Defender, but the PD's office had a conflict, so Judge Kelly subsequently appointed private counsel through alternate defense counsel. That's Ms. Stokes, Gwendolyn Stokes. And Ms. Stokes was appointed and apparently did nothing. She didn't even enter an appearance in the case. There's no sign that she did anything. Eventually, the case came up for a review hearing, and Judge Kelly then took it, made the decision to deny the pro se motion without a hearing. And it's our position that Judge Kelly erred in doing that. What he should have done was either issued some kind of an order, a show cause order, asking Ms. Stokes to submit a status report. In other words, what was going on, even confirming that she received her notice of appointment, or in the alternative, appointed replacement post-conviction counsel. Just by way of background, Your Honors, Mr. Moore was charged with attempted first-degree murder and illegal discharge of a weapon in 2004. And the charges arose out of a drive-by shooting incident in Colorado Springs. Mr. Moore allegedly shot at a white SUV, which was being driven by a man by the name of Mershon Redman, and in which Mr. Redman's girlfriend, Alyssa Simmons, and a friend of Mr. Redman's, Stephen Thomas, were riding as passengers. And Ms. Simmons was shot, apparently accidentally, by Mr. Redman, who was returning fire at the vehicle that was shooting at him. The only witness who identified my client as the shooter was Mr. Redman. And my client, Mr. Moore, testified at trial that not only was he not the shooter, he wasn't even in the area when this occurred. Now, Mr. Redman had some credibility problems in this case, so we're not talking about a case of overwhelming evidence of guilt. He was a convicted felon. Mr. Redman admitted to not telling the truth initially to investigators who were looking into this incident. And he had a history of animosity towards the Moore family. Following the trial, my client was found guilty of the lesser included offense of attempted second degree murder, as well as the firearms discharge offense. His conviction was upheld by this court in 2008, and in July of 2009, he filed his pro se motion for post-conviction relief, that being the one that we're here on now, that Judge Kelly denied. Your Honor, under Rule 35C, there are very specific circumstances under which a court can deny a motion for post-conviction relief under Rule 35C without a hearing. And those are set forth in Roman numeral 5. And they're listed. The first one is if the motion is filed untimely. That's not an issue here because the direct appeal was decided in 2008. My client's motion was filed July 1st, 2009. It's within the 3-year time limit. The second reason is if the post-conviction relief motion fails to state adequate factual or legal grounds for relief. In this case, it's our position that the motion did set forth adequate factual and legal grounds. In fact, there were allegations that there was a failure to object to improper jury instructions, failure to request a unanimity instruction, and failure to bring in certain witnesses to testify. Judge Cisneros looked at these allegations and determined that there was enough there to warrant at least appointment of counsel to investigate further. The next reason is if the motion states legal grounds for relief, which are not meritorious. The only possible legal bar to Mr. Moore's claim would be what I call the Villarreal issue, and I'm going to discuss that in a moment. Actually, given the fact that I'm rapidly using up my time, I think I'm going to cut to the Villarreal issue. But I think the panel is familiar with People versus Villarreal and the holding by another division of this court that basically said that if a defendant is unable to establish plain error in a direct appeal, the defendant is not going to be able to establish the prejudice prong under Strickland. It's my understanding that that case is still in front of the Supreme Court on certiorari. And in talking with counsel from Ms. Villarreal, that case was argued last spring, so it's unknown when there's going to be a decision. But in light of the fact that that case is up on review by the Supreme Court, you know, what happens there is going to have a big impact on what will happen to Mr. Moore's case.
Ask you about, I mean, is Villarreal even relevant here? I mean, in terms of, we had a direct appeal here, and it's my understanding that the division in the direct appeal found that the jury instructions were not improper. So why do you even get to the issue of plain error?
I believe it was limited. The scope of review in the direct appeal was limited because it wasn't properly preserved. And it's our position that if there had been, if the issue had been preserved, there would have been a fuller review of that claim.
And what would the outcome have been?
It's our claim that with a fuller review and in light of the case of People versus Simmons, it should have been the other way. In other words, it should have been found to have been error, and it would have been prejudicial error.
I agree that in Villarreal, however, the direct appeal division found that their court had erred, but it wasn't plain error because it wasn't prejudicial.
Okay.
Whereas in this case, the more direct appeal, they found not that there wasn't prejudice, but that there was no error in the failure to give the unanimity instruction. Doesn't that distinguish the situation completely so that we don't have to wait for Villarreal to be decided?
Conceivably. Okay.
All right.
I don't want to interrupt your flow on Villarreal. If you're done talking about that, I have a question about the allegations that were made in the 35C application. I didn't see anything in the 35C application where defendant said that he told his trial counsel what this other witness would testify to. Why isn't that a bar to his claim?
Because, Your Honor, this was a pro se pleading. And it's our position that had counsel been appointed, and had counsel done the work that a 35C lawyer will do, which is meet with the defendant, ask a lot of questions of the defendant, read the trial record, look at the trial attorney's file, look at the discovery from the prosecution in the case, that post-conviction counsel would have asked the client to flesh out some of these details.
Isn't that then a basis potentially for a 35C based on ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel?
I thought you were going to go there, Your Honor. I thought somebody was going to ask that question. And that very well may be what happens next. It's a matter of judicial economy that this case should have been handled differently in the El Paso District Court with regard to appointment of a new 35C counsel, and to find out why Ms. Stokes didn't do anything on this. And it's inexplicable what went on there. But conceivably, there could be a 35C of the 35C lawyer, Your Honor, depending on what happens here, I think. And that's just adding another layer to the onion.
Do you have any idea whether Mr. Moore told counsel how to reach this owner of the car, where he could reach him, what he was going to say? Is there anything in the record that supports it besides this assertion?
No.
And we have no idea why this other, the owner of the car wasn't called. We have no idea.
We don't, and that's one of my points, is had counsel been appointed and gone through it doing the post-conviction relief work, you know, doing the investigation and then filing an appropriate motion or brief and requesting a hearing if it was warranted, then that could have been, that's the kind of stuff that post-conviction counsel would have done in the trial court.
Ryan also alleges that in his motion that counsel failed to impeach the officer with the statements in the probable cause affidavit. Do we know if the probable cause affidavit was used as an exhibit at trial at all?
I don't know that, Your Honor.
Do we know if the police officer was cross-examined about his report at all? Male or female officer, I don't even remember.
I may have the answer to that if I could look.
Sorry to make that.
just
why don't you stop the The timer. I'm just.
We call it injury timeout.
Injury timeout, okay. And which one do I?
No, you don't have to do it.
You don't have to do anything.
The bailiff will do it.
Thank you for offering to do that, counsel. We'll wait for you.
Thank you.
Did you get back into play?
It's kind of like the, kind of like the NFL. We don't start the clock until the defense is ready. So.
Thank you. I'm looking at the notes from my review of the trial record, and Officer Mahone did testify, and the question was, what was the question, what specific?
He or she cross-examined about the police affidavit, or was it used at all in that testimony?
It doesn't look like it under cross-examination. I'm just looking to.
So in other words, we don't know why Mr. Moore's trial counsel did not.
Correct.
Cross-examine Officer Mahon about what was in the affidavit. We don't know that either.
Correct, Your Honor. And there may have been a sound strategic reason for doing it. We don't know that. And that's one of my points, is that had counsel done the investigation at the 35C level, at the trial court level, that's something that post-conviction counsel could have asked Cynthia Jones, who I guess was the public defender who actually tried the case. But that would be a question that would be appropriate to ask. If there are no more questions, I would reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
And you've got a little over 4 minutes for any rebuttal that you want.
May it please the court, John first for the people. I guess I'd like to start first with a minor correction of the factual, the facts, what happened on 35C. Justice Narrows did not appoint counsel. That initial order under her initial review sent her over to the public defender. I've got the order right here. And consistent with 35C, wanted the public defender to indicate whether it intended to enter. So we have no appointment at that point. I mean, when nothing came of that, then it was, then Judge Kelly stepped in, said, you know, found that there had been no response from the public defender, and but at the same time found a conflict, and Judge Kelly then appointed counsel and set these generous review dates that are even generous, I say, and with respect to 35C, that they have 45 days to answer. The Judge Kelly gave 90, and then set another 60 days after that for review. Yeah, I mean, it certainly is a question why appointed counsel didn't do anything, but that's the stuff of another proceeding, not this. Judge Richman, to answer your question, it was I reviewed the record briefly, and it was, and looking for exactly what you were looking for, whether or not the counsel used the probable cause affidavit to cross the officer. And I didn't bring those notes, and that's my fault. But it was my review that looked like a couple questions, and the court can verify it, can take a look for itself. But I compared some of the statements in the probable cause affidavit with some of the questioning. It looked like it did. There was no specific reference to the affidavit, but it looked like it did. But we can't.
Saying that defendant use the probable cause affidavit or the prosecutor?
On cross, the defense counsel, it looked like, used some of the information in the probable cause affidavit. I don't even want to speculate now why, but that's in my, but there was no explicit reference to it. And certainly counsel didn't ask about the statement that is the subject of
that. When he fired the gun, he had no, he did not have any idea of what he was shooting at.
He didn't ask that question, no. But there,
She.
Right, sorry.
Did not ask that question.
Obviously didn't ask that, and that's not what I'm saying, right. But it did appear to me that it's possible defense counsel did have the affidavit, but that, again, that would be the,
you know. We don't know why, then, she didn't ask that question.
Obviously,
we can't.
Yes. And so
I guess the bottom line is the thing that may be concerning us is if looking at the record, we don't know why, either because there was a conscious strategic choice or the defense lawyer forgot about it or the defense lawyer didn't know about it. If we don't know any of those reasons, isn't that exactly why we have a 35C hearing to ferret that out?
Well, that only goes, I mean, that's true. I mean, 35C hearings are obviously, you know, are for factual findings, factual determinations, and then to which the law would be applied. But that's only one prong. That's not the performance prong.
So why wouldn't there be prejudice here if this really was a credibility case? Or maybe you take issue with that.
Well, I did in my brief, at least, and I think I'll continue to here. It wasn't just a credibility case. I mean, primarily because, defense at trial wrote alibi, and his own witness contradicted his alibi, and in contradicting the alibi, contradicted the defendant's testimony.
Hold on.
Sure.
Defendant's alibi was, summarily say, I wasn't there. Someone else said, you weren't with me. But no one said he was there at the scene other than this Mr. Redmond. Isn't that correct?
That's true.
The woman in the car that was with her who accidentally got shot, she didn't identify the defendant.
That's true.
And the guy in the back seat, he disappeared. I think he was completely gone, wasn't he? Stefan Thomas or whatever his name was.
I think so.
So it was really Redmond versus the defendant saying he was there, and he's saying, I wasn't there. There was that credibility dispute.
That's true.
Okay. So if Redmond's credibility was at stake, would it not have been possibly made a difference if the owner of the vehicle testified, Redmond told me he didn't know who he was shooting at, or whatever the client's
name is? Yeah, and again, for two different reasons. And that's why I paused before I went into the alibi. You know, there was other impeachment of Richmond. There was inconsistencies in his testimony. The jury saw that. What we're talking about is incremental. I mean, and just slightly incremental in terms of the impeachment value that this would have lent to the defense. And I say that because, I mean, you look at, what was the statement? Had no idea what he was shooting at. That's the testimony. Didn't say who he was shooting at. And to the extent that, I mean, in a reply brief, defense counsel says, well, it's subject to different inferences.
That's the statement in the police.
The statement in the police report says, when he fired the four shots, he did not have any idea of what he was shooting at or if he had hit anything or anyone. That's a direct quote.
But the defendant said in his Rule 35, Mr. Smith told me that Redmond had said he didn't know who had shot at him and instead just suspected it was Mr. Moore.
Well, my understanding was that he was basing that on the police report and misstating the police report, not on what that witness told him.
I'm reading from page 10 of the Rule 35, and he says, counsel failed to interview and call Smith, whom would have testified that Redmond told him and what I just said. So he seems to be alleging that the owner of the car, Smith, I believe he's the owner of the car, had apparently had a conversation with Redmond that might have helped impeach Redmond. But we don't know. Do we know why Smith wasn't called as a witness in this case?
There's no indication in the record. It appears that it clearly that it wasn't. It looks like, as I said, from the bit that I could see in the record, that he wasn't served, wasn't subpoenaed because there was a question mark on the day of trial witnesses with a question mark service.
Trial day, whose trial witness list was that where that question mark appears? I could not discern from the record whether that was the prosecution's list.
I couldn't tell if it was one of the parties or the court's list. The court's list.
Right. That's another question that might be answered if we set it back for a further hearing.
Well, this court has to find there's reasonable probability that the outcome of the trial would have been different. And
to lead to another question. What exactly was the court's reasons for denying this motion?
I agree. There weren't any. I mean,
there weren't any given by the trial court.
Well, no specific reasons, no.
Okay.
Well, I mean, we wish the order had been better. But, you know, again, on appeal, we can defend on any grounds, which is what we're attempting to do.
I just want to make sure I understand.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry.
What I hear you saying is that your argument is based on the prejudice problem.
Of course.
That neither the trial court nor we on review, we can't say that there's a reasonable probability that the result would be different. That's essentially what your argument is on this particular contention.
On this, yes, on this contention, and then based on this record.
Okay.
No, we don't have any. But what I was going to say, Judge, is that what we do have, and in the court's order, this court indicated that it had carefully reviewed the motion and the court's file. We have to take the court at its word. We also know the court was aware of the proper standards, cited Strickland, cited a few other cases here, Gandiaga and Artolino. So we know that the court applied the law that we don't have are specific findings. And again, as I said, we can, you know, on appeal, I mean, we presume that this order is correct, and we can defend on any grounds. So that.
About the instructional issue, what's your response on the Villarreal case, and what effect, if any, it should have on the disposition of this case?
None. As the court pointed out, and as I said in my brief, that Villarreal and the other case, and I think that I can. Villarreal was argued last March in the Supreme Court. There's another unpublished case with the same issue, that's Hagos, and the reply brief was due today after some extension, so we're
this is another case on cert in the Supreme Court.
Yes,
we're the same issue.
It's the same issue.
Hagos.
Oh, yeah. I think it's Hagos too. It's possible if the brief is filed today, it could be argued in March. There's the court sitting the first week in March. So if it's not March, it's going to be, there's no argument setting till May. So that's the status of that. And both Villarreal and Hagos involved erroneous instructions. Judge Loeb, as you pointed out, the direct appeal panel in this case found no error. You know, and going back to the police report, so I'm just looking at the we do have to assume the truth of the allegation for 35C purposes. I mean, that it was, we're not talking about the affidavit, that we're talking about the statement that defendant said that Mr. Redmond told him he did not know who shot at him and said just suspected. So assuming that's true.
Mr. Smith would have said that.
Well, no, that's right. But Mr. Smith would have said what Mr. Redmond told him. And even assuming that truth, we still have other impeachment evidence. Because this isn't, you know, even to take most, even
okay, this, what other impeachment evidence was there of Mr. Redmond's, Mr. Redmond's identification of defendant as the shooter? I know Mr. Redmond was cross-examined up and down the wall about his credibility. I read that. I never saw that defense counsel ask him one question about his identity of the defendant as the shooter.
That's true. Okay. But I will say that, I mean,
this has been a strategic reason. I don't know.
But but again, that goes, we're not talking about the first problem. We're talking about prejudice.
Okay.
And as to prejudice, this doesn't say, the statement isn't something to the effect that, well, you know, Mr. Smith told me that, Redmond told me that he didn't see who did it, or it was somebody else. He said he only suspected it. So that in itself is incremental. If it were different, if it were words to the effect that, well, no, it was somebody else, or I didn't see who did it, or something clear like that. But this says, Redmond only said, assuming it's true for these purposes, he only suspected it. In light, and this is what I was getting at with the alibi. Defendant's testimony was contradicted by his own alibi witness. Mr. Moore said, I was at home playing video games, watching TV. His brother, his cousin, Mr. Clark, I can't remember. His alibi witness said, no, we were out riding around. Well, what is an alibi? It says, I wasn't there. Right. And in rejecting that, they rejected his alibi that he wasn't there. If he wasn't there, he was there, first of all. Second of all, it undermined his own testimony. I mean,
he was only there if you accept Mr. Redmond's testimony when he said, who was shooting at you? Answer, Daniel Moore. It was an absolute identification, not a suspected. Yes. So then if Mr. Smith would come up and say, well, he told me he didn't know who was shooting at him, wouldn't that be a different level of impeachment than what we got in this trial?
In light of all the evidence, no. And I see I'm out of time, so I just ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. First.
Just very...
Take your time.
Wait.
I'm getting faster on this.
You're not going anywhere.
We're not going to pay your injury, please.
I just have a couple of points I wanted to respond to, Your Honors. First of all, regarding discussion of the alibi defense, even assuming for the sake of argument there may have been some gaps in some of the alibi evidence, that has absolutely nothing to do with the issue of the identification of my client as the shooter. I think that the whole thing hinges on Mr. Redmond's testimony, and I think Judge Richmond hit the nail right on the head on that one. A couple of other points regarding the prejudice prong of Strickland and whether this could be resolved simply on the prejudice prong. With all due respect, it can't be, because I think that there has to be an evidentiary hearing in order for a court to hear witnesses, to measure the quality of what this evidence would have been, and then make a determination whether it would have affected the outcome of the case, the original trial, or not. I don't think that can be done at this stage in the proceedings. The last thing I wanted to mention was Judge Kelly's order. And it was unusual when I read it, in that basically he was making a factual determination. Well, he didn't state facts, but he made conclusions that the defendant couldn't establish deficient representation, and that he couldn't establish prejudice based simply upon Judge Kelly's review of the original trial record. A 35C proceeding by its nature often requires evidence outside that record, so it's not possible to make a determination by simply looking at the record as it existed based on the what happened at trial. The last thing I wanted to mention was, and I've only got a page of notes based on when I read the record in this case, and it's a page of notes about Officer Sean Mahone's testimony, and I would obviously defer to the court reviewing the actual testimony of Officer Mahone in the cross-examination, but it's on May 5th, 2005, and it starts on page 154, and I think it runs to page 178. So, unfortunately, my notes are rather sparse, but I don't see anything in my notes where there was questioning along the lines that has been discussed here today. Unless there are any questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate you coming in today. The case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course.